Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Commodity culture in Victorian England and the invention of the slum in America. This week on Soundings.
What it does is allows us to see how advertisers interact with certain kinds of social institutions at certain times to produce the durable images of modern culture. The shopping mall had to be invented, and it was at this particular moment in 1851 when all the various elements which had been floating around culture for a long time came together.
The commodity culture of Victorian England. You'll hear from Thomas Richards of Harvard University. Following that, a discussion about the invention of the slum in America, this week on Soundings. You'll hear from Henry Binford of Northwestern University.
What I'm interested in is, this again gets back to the term invention, I'm interested not only in the appearance of these places, the concentrated, distinctive, homogeneous settlements of the very poor in the heart of the city, but also in the invention of the notion, the invention of the concept of the slum.
Henry Binford of Northwestern University. More from Henry Binford later on Soundings this week. First, a conversation with Thomas Richards. The title of Tom Richards' most recent book is The Commodity Culture of Victorian England, published by Stanford University Press.
By commodity culture, I mean a culture in which the world, as the public sees it, is oriented around commodities, around representing them, around buying them, around selling them. But I mean more than a culture that simply makes and uses things. One of the interesting things I sort of unearthed in putting together that book was that all cultures have been consumer cultures. And consumer culture is sort of the term that the title of the book plays off against, because most books published on the issue of the status of commodities in modern culture, or even in 18th or 19th century culture, talk about the formation of a specifically consumer culture, that is, a culture oriented around the use of things.
Well, what would be the difference, for example, between a commodity culture and a culture where, I mean, the most primitive of societies, where we have nothing but bartering going on?
Yeah, the distinction I draw, which is pretty basic, is that a commodity culture is a culture saturated with representations of commodities.
In other words, not the things themselves, but the emblems that surround the exchange of all these things.
Yeah, emblems, images, all sorts of cultural materials. Sometimes it can be musical, like a jingle, and jingles go way back. Sometimes it can be material adapted from popular culture, such as the cries of street callers in Victorian London. At other times, it can be material that's specifically verbal, such as inversions of poetic forms. It's still common to see little bits and snippets of poetry drifting through advertisements.
Why do you locate this study of commodity culture in Victorian England? I mean, we have the rise of, the rise of capitalism, the building of the industrial state. I take it that that's part of your argument.
Yeah, that's there. But the reason that Victorian England is so very interesting is that the formation of a world in which we talk primarily and almost exclusively in some places about commodities has to do with certain kinds of events that shaped the representation of commodities.
What do you mean, for example?
Well, when people talk about the rise of capitalism, it sounds like some slowly rising monster rearing its head out of a swamp.
Right.
And it's not. What happened is certain particular events allowed advertisers who were very unimportant in the 18th century and not at all crucial to the way capitalism saw itself to experiment with different ways of representing commodities.
All right. So, for example, you would have the what was it called? The Crystal Palace, the Great Exhibition of mid-century. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that. Why is that important to your argument?
Well, the Crystal Palace was the first of everything. I mean, it was the first department store. It was the first mall. It was the first enclosed greenhouse. It was this huge glass enclosed space full of trees. I mean, it looks like the Galleria in the San Fernando Valley in LA. I mean, except that there's a little more glass there. It was a space that was the product of almost the mind of a committee, but on a somewhat more complex level. 1848 was a year of revolution. It was a little bit like, you know, 1789, 1917. It was one of those great revolutionary outpourings. And the middle classes in England found themselves palpably threatened by the classes that lay underneath them. And increasingly, they found that one of the best means of social control is to direct massive social promises at the public at large. That is, we will promise you not just well-being or happiness, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but we will make life concrete. We will make liberty palpable. We will make happiness understandable in the form of things.
And I understand that this is a deflection. Is that where you're taking this argument, that the things themselves do not represent
anything,
any form of social harmony or happiness?
I mean, the same crud that's lying around your house, or that you see anywhere in a junkyard or
which
an antique
is continually
shop.
Hyped in all of the mm-hmm. language of advertising.
Right, a thing is nothing in itself, and if you look at the, you know, philosophical status of things in the 18th century,
mm-hmm.
Things were no big deal. There's all sorts of empirical philosophy that
you mean. You mean possessions, clothes, the way people traveled, the way they communicated.
No, those were all a big deal, but the status of things was not elevated. I mean, obviously, things have always played a big part in the social gambits of self-representation. You know, like sumptuary laws in Elizabethan England. You know, the things you wore showed what class you were. The difference is that in the 19th century, things in themselves
began to acquire.
Right. A thing took on a kind of magical aura. At the time, Marx has a famous passage of Capital where he talks about what he calls commodity fetishism. And basically what this is things that have a magical appearance, as if they're made out of nothing, as if they come out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of consult your memory to, you know, reference any TV ad. You know, about, you know, a car driving, you know, along the California coast or something like that. That car's not made by anyone. Rather, it just seems like a magical object. It doesn't consume gas from the Persian Gulf.
Well, let me argue with you for a moment, Tom Richards. What's wrong with equating things with our inherent values if, in fact, we have no other way to express them? If, for example, religion doesn't do the trick, if we can't all agree on a central set of religious emblems, if we don't all share a sort of common philosophical discourse or language, what else is there to create the way we talk back and forth and represent ourselves to one another than the things mm-hmm. that we own and pass back and forth?
Well, I think your question implies its answer. The way you phrased it, the answer to this is that the cultural pluralism of the United States is so impossibly diverse
mm-hmm.
that we need a kind of lowest common denominator hookup between the various groups.
And it's called network television right now, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, network consumption, really.
Uh-huh.
I mean, since TV is primarily a vehicle to sell the little ads, you know, the things that appear between it.
TV, in your view, is a symptom of this commodity culture. It's not really the cause of it.
Yeah, I would say so.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do want to be fair to that culture and say that the culture, although intended quite clearly to sell things, does not always succeed in selling them. That is, sometimes there are cultural materials that are encoded or expressed in an advertisement that do not necessarily help something to be sold.
Uh-huh.
So you can be selling something like a perfume, and you have all of these sort of supple human bodies being represented. And it may well be that the representation that you've created of your perfume is so powerful and so self-sufficient that it will suck the reader of the ad into the representation itself, and the representation almost becomes a work of art. It, mm-hmm. it has an aesthetic impact comparable to great art. But I do think that that one of the roles of the advertiser and of the aesthetics they create is to create kind of false images of common being.
All right. Now, you mentioned a moment ago, Tom Richards, the protest. In other words, the antithetical impulse. Does the advertising world, does the commodity culture contain within it the seeds of its own destruction?
The first thing it does is locate volatile areas of cultural representation. Mm-hmm. That can have to do with sexuality. It can have to do with medical discourse and health. It can have to do with a massive social desires, usually for a better world.
Right.
But then it takes the desire for a better world, which is, after all, the old kind of religious construction of a better world in the beyond, and it turns it into this vague word better, like better jewelry, or better this,
new
or better
and
that.
New and improved.
Right, in which nothing refers to anything, and the word better refers not to a world, but to the fact that something unspecified is better than something else, which is also not specified.
It refers to the world of advertising and nothing else. It refers to that plane of reality and not to anything that has a physical or a mental, spiritual correspondence in our everyday lives.
Well, again, I think that the actual content of advertisements is extremely variable, and advertisers are always watching one another to see whether anyone is keying into one of the central organizing fictions of social life. And because these fictions change from time to time, right, like we got this greed thing in the 80s where we had more an idealistic thing in the 60s,
right,
people, advertisers are always kind of looking at one another to see what they can use and what they can get away with using. The alternative to the commodity culture is a culture in which things are used but not valorized, in which things play roles in our lives, as they do in you know, so-called primitive cultures. One of the interesting areas now is the anthropology of things. People have always valued things.
But they are not ends in and of themselves.
No, they're not ends in and of themselves. And I think what we do now is we ensure that our society cannot change by making people desire not a better world, but a better grouping of things, a better style for themselves, however you want to, whether it's fashion, cars, or whatever. People are taught to desire things. And as such, I think that there's a basic dishonesty built into the way we represent things. And it's sad, I think, to constantly watch things and be surrounded by lies, because in the end, I do think that although the lies are powerful and although they're powerfully expressed and that can be studied aesthetically using various means, that I do think that what we're looking at is the slow saturation of a society with the methods, means, and procedures of untruth.
Thomas Richards teaches at Harvard University. His most recent book is The Commodity Culture of Victorian England, available from Stanford University Press. Tom Richards is working on a study about knowledge and the state in Imperial Britain. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Soundings on Commerce and Culture continues. You'll hear next from another scholar at the National Humanities Center. Henry Binford teaches at Northwestern University. During his stay at the center, Henry Binford is working on a study entitled The Invention of the Slum in America.
The process of industrialization, first of all, in the economic dimension, required the assembly of very large numbers of low-skilled people close to the places where they worked. That meant that you had bigger concentrations of poor people than ever before in the urban areas and areas especially near the factories or near industrial work. Of course, poverty has always been with us, but what's different about these kinds of areas is the numbers and the concentration and the homogeneity that is emerging in the 19th century. By the same token, the assembly of all these people meant that there are a lot of poor people whose jobs are usually unstable. Most working class people, and certainly all poor people in the 19th century, did not have what we call a steady job. They had episodic employment. They were lucky to have employment at all. If they did, it was usually for a few weeks, maybe if they're lucky, a few months. They might go for then a period of unemployment and then get work again and so forth and so on, which meant that any individual had to be near lots of possible sources of employment.
Mm-hmm.
Moreover, when the city grew, the wealthier, the more affluent people, this is another whole dimension of the story, move toward the outskirts. This is the birth of the suburb. That's another 19th century word.
Urban blight and suburban flight.
Urban blight and suburban flight, yes. Now, blight is another whole term, but we won't get into that right now. That's all these words have interesting histories. The removal of the affluent leaves behind the poor, in part because they not only need to be near work, but they can't afford to use transportation. They can't afford to ride omnibuses or horse-drawn streetcars or any of that kind of thing.
So they were automatically drawn together.
That's right, and compelled together, compressed
right.
together.
Right.
That's one part of this process I call invention. That's the economic part, and it has to do with the cost of transportation, with the availability of housing, with the availability of work, and of course then with the possibilities for exploiting this situation by mm-hmm. landlords and people with housing to let, so that you get large numbers of people who can't afford to be any place but in this one concentrated area, but who have to have housing and haven't got much to pay, and they get exploited. Slumlords become rampant.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes slumlords who are just a rung higher on the scale than the people they're renting to. One of the classic ways to make money in the slums is to try to rent out a piece of whatever dwelling you have to somebody else who needs a place to stay.
Oh. And then this is where you come up with these statistics about unbelievable numbers of people inhabiting an incredibly small amount of space.
Oh, yeah. In fact, in London and in every American city, this is one of the interesting things that I think most Americans, certainly I didn't know until I began looking into this, the density of population in most American cities hits a peak in the early part of the 19th century.
The early part of the 19th century.
Yes. That's the overall density of population. Now, of course, there are situations later where you get more people on a particular piece of turf, especially when you get high-rise buildings and so forth. But the mm-hmm. overall density hits a peak for the cities because beginning in the 1830s and 40s, this outward dispersal that I'm talking about of the affluent people gradually lowers the density of the city as a whole. There is a period, however, there in the 40s and 50s where the affluent haven't moved very far or very much, and the poor are pouring into the cities looking for work, oftentimes can't find work in the rural areas, so here they are in the cities, and you get maximum density. You get incredible densities at
right.
that point.
Do you talk about good guys and bad guys? Do you assign blame? Do you actually talk about individuals as well as social forces in
sure,
the study?
Sure. There are characters in here, although I'm not looking for heroes and villains. This is there's a story here. There are lots of stories. And in fact, one of the things I'm interested in is the several stories in different cities mm-hmm. and how they blend together so that by the end of the 19th century, we have something called the slum that everybody agrees on.
Yeah, now you use Boston, Cincinnati, Chicago, and New Orleans. Good geographical spread there. What's your object there in picking those cities?
Yeah, well, I've got, actually, that's the current roster of cities. There are others that I've considered and rejected and others that may find their way back into the list. There's a story in every city, and I'm interested in all those stories, but I can't, if I want to finish this book before I retire, I'm not going to do them all. I'm looking for geographical spread. I picked those because they're all cities that were big cities in the 19th century, and I got to have big cities to have slums in that period. These are all cities whose population was over 100,000 at the time of the Civil War, and that's a big city in the 19th century. I wanted southern and northern. I wanted old seaport cities on the coast. I wanted Midwestern representatives. I wanted places where there were Irish, where there were Germans, where there were African Americans. Who made up the laboring population of the city. I wanted places that had different kinds of local culture, different kinds of civic culture, different sorts of stories of commitment. And that's where the individuals come in. I'd rather not talk about good guys and bad guys, because part of my job is to explain why everybody was doing what they did.
Mm-hmm.
I think, as in every story, there are heroes and villains. There are people who are venal and greedy and short-sighted and nasty, and there are people who are idealistic and heroic and good-hearted and civically oriented and so forth. But they're all part of this process of invention. No Edison, but lots of Edisons, I guess is what we're saying.
Fair enough, Henry Binford. Where does the study take us?
A moment ago, we were talking about a nation of homeowners. The United States, that's one of our distinguishing characteristics. there was a moment in 1931 when there was a presidential conference on housing and homeownership, called by Hoover, but really called by Hoover kind of against his own hunches because of enormous pressure from economists and builders and the banking industry and so forth. This is in the early stages of the Depression, and at a point where a lot of people worried about the mortgage system and housing and so forth. This conference took a broad purview and considered the whole arena of homeownership. Now, that conference is interesting to a lot of people, but it's interesting to me because out of that conference came very clear, they thought, very clear and concise definitions of terms like slum and blight and a variety of other things, which influenced local government officials, federal government officials, the architects of the whole system of what we came to think of as urban renewal in another decade or two after this. Mm-hmm. The idea of slum clearance, which was not a new idea in 1931, but if you're going to clear a slum, you have to have some definition of what it is. And in 1931 may be the end of this project I'm working on now because it's a convenient stopping point. But what I'm after there is the coming together of a whole cluster of ideas about poverty, about urban geography, about policy, about the way the city should grow in a healthy, normal fashion, and the ways it grows abnormally. Uh-huh. And abnormal growth produces slums.
And I take it that you resort to what sorts of metaphors there when you describe abnormal growth?
Well, they resorted to the metaphor of blight. That's the key one there. Uh-huh. And also slums. They thought of slums as, by the 1930s, they were thinking of slums as the kind of thing you get, kind of like a cancerous growth. That's right. Why so often when you read magazine articles or newspaper articles in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, down into the 1960s about what to do about the slums, and when they talk about slum clearance, there are these graphic, stark metaphors of cancer. Mm-hmm. These are tumors in our cities. We have to cut them out. These are areas of cancerous growth in our cities. Now, this is interesting because what they're talking about is places where poor people have been trying to find a home.
They're talking mainly about people. They're not talking about buildings.
That's right. Well, they are talking about buildings, but from the point of view of those who live there, these are houses, homes, communities. And oftentimes, there are a numbers of sometimes very tragic stories in the 1950s, especially, where the apparatus of slum clearance from local government, from the banking industry, descends upon a neighborhood which is deemed to be a slum and cancerous growth.
And has a result which is precisely the opposite of what they're looking for.
That's right.
For.
And the people who are in this neighborhood say, What's this is our home.
Yeah. Henry Binford, you're writing about the invention of the slum in 19th century America. Race and gender, two very large, what do you call them, problems, challenges, difficulties that enter into this description that you're doing?
All those things, I think, is what I call them. And it's how they enter in that's part of what I'm interested in. The notion of the slum originally had to do with poverty and housing. During the 19th century, it took on lots of other overtones, connotations, parts of the package, and different ones in England than in America, and different ones in different parts of America, and so right. forth. But of course, by the 20th century, race has a lot to do with slums, and gender a good deal as well, although we don't often think about that as much.
Yeah, but you don't approach your study of the invention of the slum in terms of a necessary connection binding race, gender, invention of the slum.
Indeed, one of the curious things about all changes in usage of this term, this concept, is the way in which it comes to be in the 20th century almost automatically connected with race. When I speak with people...
Yeah, we have code words. We use code words.
Sure. And the code words change too, of course. When I speak with people nowadays, if I meet somebody at a party or on the street or whatnot, and they ask me what I'm doing, and I say the invention of the slum, they immediately think I'm talking about African-American people in the United States. And how that came to be is, again, part of the story. Because, in fact, if you look for the earliest usages of that term, let alone all the things that go along with it, in the United States, they don't have to do with black people at all. In fact, black people are often exempted from the usage of the term. In the beginning, if they have to do with any ethnic minority, it's the Irish.
Uh-huh.
In
Boston.
And in New York.
Right, I see.
And that's in part a carryover from England, where the usages were often attached to Irish communities in the city. But it's in part a connection with the Great Migration of the 1840s and 50s of Irish people to the United States. It comes to be loaded with racial meaning sometime in the late 19th century. And again, that's part of the puzzle I'm trying to figure out. And then in the 20th century, almost exclusively, this is partly, of course, connected with the arrival of very large numbers of black people in northern cities, especially in the United States.
Uh-huh. What, after the Civil War?
Well, beginning after the Civil War and then explosively after World War I.
I see.
But the change in usage begins even before that.
Mm-hmm.
It's also connected, I think, with ideas about who's powerful and who's weak. And
Who's on the margin and who's at the center.
That's right. And right. Margin and center, in fact, are better terms because there's a lot of geographical thinking about this. When African-American people in the big city become the people that the white majority doesn't want to have next door, that's when the name for the place that's not next door, that is slum, place, the ultimate not next door place, gets attached to the African-American population. Now, I think this process happens a little differently in the South, where, of course, African-American people have been the bulk of the poor and working class population for a long time.
We've always got to have other. We always have to have opposition. We've got to have somebody that we pick on for the purposes of defining the problem.
Yes, and blaming it on them, usually. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And who that is changes.
Henry Binford teaches at Northwestern University. During his fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Henry Binford is working on a project entitled The Invention of the Slum in America. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. For a cassette copy of this edition of Soundings, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 555. That's program number 555. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. For a complete summary of Soundings discussions available on cassettes, send $2. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings. Next week, a discussion about medicine, social ethics, and genetic engineering. Listen for Michael Waldholtz of the Wall Street Journal and Alan Roses, a physician from the Duke University Medical Center. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Profits and Poverty, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for Thomas Richards of Harvard University and Henry Binford of Northwestern University. Tom Richards will discuss his new book, The Commodity Culture of Victorian England. Henry Binford will talk about his study of the invention of the slum in America. Profits and Poverty, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.